Blog Talk Radio. The following program is brought to you by Firefly Willows, LIVE.
Hi, my name is Steven Solberg.
Hi, I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life.
Welcome to A Shamanic Life with your host, John Carosella. Today's featured guest is Stephen Guy Solberg, an artist, activist, and film director who is using both Western and shamanic resources in his battle with cancer. We'll also hear a powerful report from Ana Maria Sanchez, author, healer, and representative to the United Nations for this year's Commission on the Status of Women. In Spirit, Muse, and Song, John talks with Grammy-nominated artist Gentle Thunder, who has gone from rock and roll drummer to healer through the power of sacred music making. She'll share some of her enchanting work on the hammer dulcimer, Native American flute, and more. Also on today's program, visionary artist Annette Wagner joins John for part 3 of The Vision Plan, a business plan from the heart. John will speak with Karen Armstrong, founder of the Shamanic Life online community. And Gina Carosella will share The Sensory Experience, a deep dive into the world of the senses. We're not just doing shamanism, we're living it. Come along with us. It's A Shamanic Life.
Welcome to A Shamanic Life. I'm John Carosella here with Shamanic Life online community founder Karen Armstrong. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being here.
So we've got a really cool show lined up tonight. But before we get to that, I just want to mention that, you know, we've just had a kind of a tragedy in this country that leaves all of us uncertain. This bombing in Boston at the end of the Boston Marathon. And, you know, this is a time when we can really dig deep and reach for our spiritual support and ask for healing for everyone who is involved, those who suffered physical and psychological trauma at the location. We can offer and ask for relief of stress and anxiety. And we can actually, you know, I feel like it's important to ask for healing for the wound that exists in humankind that draws us, the sum of us, some among us, into such terrifying acts of desperation. And, you know, I don't know what else to say. Maybe you have some thoughts on this, Karen, but, you know, we got this big wound. We don't even know what it looks like, but it causes these terrible things to happen.
Well, thanks for sharing that, John. I my first thought is that we need to heal the anger within us or inside of us. Because it is that place of desperation for survival that people are acting out, regardless of, you know, who did it, you know, who was what culture, what country, was it terrorism, was it this, was it that? I think we just need to dig deep and ask how we can heal our anger and our rage and our own destruction.
Yeah, and you know, we're all one here. So, you know, the fact that this exists outside of us means that we have work to do inside of us to try to bring it to some kind of closure and to soothe it. You know, this anger is an expression of frustration and helplessness. And so if we are really going to put a salve on this anger, we have to go to the root, which is that there are those among us who feel a desperate sense of helplessness. And, you know, for whatever and however that came to be, and we can all have, you know, past judgments about that, that almost doesn't matter because we have to reach out and heal it.
I agree. And there's the flip side to that, too, that this is nothing new. I just think that, and please forgive me if that insults somebody or triggers somebody, but these types of acts of violence and terrorism, so to speak, have been going on for centuries.
Yeah, they have.
Throughout history. I think that there is a root problem, yes, but there's also a media problem. And I have purposely not watched any media around this particular issue because I'm trying to heal my own anger and rage around violence.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we're going to have that's a good point. And to that point, we're going to have Ana Maria Sanchez on the show tonight. She just came back from the United Nations, the 57th Commission on the Status of Women. And she's got some stories to tell about what she learned there and, you know, the violence against women and that is pervasive throughout much of the world. And, you know, lest anyone suspect that we're out of the woods.
Out of the woods. We're never out of the woods.
You know,
we're either deep in the woods and communing with nature or
we're deep in the woods and lost.
Yes, we're deep in the woods and lost, which is what I like to be a lot of times.
Well,
then I know my brain's learning something.
Yeah. Well, we do have healing work to do, and you know, one of the reasons that this show exists is to be a consistent call for people to step into their power and live a shamanic life and bring their shamanic tools to bear on life, you know?
Yes.
You know, and we have that with Steven Solberg, too. Steven's a perfect example of what you have to do to lead a shamanic life, right? I mean, Karen and I have history with Steven. He was in our 3-year program with the Foundation for Shamanic Studies. And, you know, he's battling cancer.
Exactly. My heart is so full when I think about him and everything that he's given to others in his life. I recall one of the sessions that we were on the shuttle together going to the airport, and I couldn't stop crying. And he just looked over and put his hand on my knee and said, "Are you having separation anxiety?" And I kept crying and crying and crying even more. And I thought, wow, just that question led me to realize that, yeah, I am having separation anxiety because the people that I was in circle with were my family.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He has given a lot. He's a beautiful soul and he does magnificent art. And our heart goes out to him because he's walking a challenging walk right now. And he's bringing to bear, and he's inviting others to bring to bear,
mm-hmm.
shamanic tools to assist him in however this is supposed to unwind. You know, of course, he's looking for healing. But, you know, we don't always get the physical cure. We sometimes get what we're destined for, I guess.
Right. Well, yeah, the physical cure, I think, is... I think the physical, that's a tough topic.
Yeah, it's a big topic. Maybe we should go into that, dedicate an episode
that.
To that.
we should table that. Yeah, I'm excited that Steve's going to be sharing his story tonight, and he deserves to be honored as the true warrior that he is.
Yeah, and we've got some other very exciting things on the show tonight. We've got... the vision plan with Annette Wagner. We're going to talk about the dream panel, and this actually was as I was reviewing it, it's really cool stuff, and I'm very excited to bring that to our listeners. It's good stuff to share. And in spirit, muse, and song, we have Gentle Thunder. She's a Grammy nominated artist. Her music, I fell in love with her music. she's just this kind of a magician on the hammer dulcimer. It's so exciting. Oh.
Wow.
And she plays a beautiful Native American flute, too. So I may actually throw in an extra tune tonight with her, because I like her music so much. It's like, wow, this is so great.
Well, when are we going to hear you play? I keep blowing on mine. I don't know where it's going, but...
Well, one of these days. I commit here and now that one of these days on A Shamanic Life, somehow some of my musical stuff will show up.
Yay! That's amazing.
Okay.
I love hearing that.
All right. Well, why don't we take our listeners right into the show? And, Karen, thanks for joining us. Thanks for your work in centering the Shamanic Life online community, and we'll be back again in 2 weeks or so.
You're welcome, and bon voyage.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
Would you like to share your shamanic life with our audience? We're always looking for featured guests who aren't just doing shamanism, but living it. If you've got stories to tell, let us know. Your stories can illuminate the path for others. If you're interested, contact us at facebook.com/shamanic life or send a message to Karen Armstrong, K-A-R-Y-N, at shamaniclife.com, or John Carosella, jc@fireflywillows.com. We're ready to listen.
I'm John Carosella. This is A Shamanic Life, and with me today is Stephen Guy Solberg. Stephen is a visual artist, actor, writer, and pioneer gay filmmaker with a film, Luminous Procurus, in the permanent collection of the Whitney Museum of American Art. An archetypal death experience, 12-step recovery, and Jungian dream work led Stephen to the study and practice of shamanism. Stephen co-founded the Los Angeles Gay Men's Medicine Circle in 1999, helping to develop workshops such as Seeing in the Dark, An Introduction to Gay Shamanism, Extraction Healing and Plant Spirit Medicine, Doctoring the Spiritual Dimensions of Illness, and Death Walker, Exploring the Role of the Psychopomp. His documentary film, Standing on the Bones of Our Ancestors, Exploring the Role of the Queer Tribal Elder, is a work in progress. He currently lives in Minneapolis, Minnesota, with his domestic partner, Christopher Miner, of Ho-Chunk descent. Stephen was diagnosed with rectal cancer in April 2012 and is presently rehabilitating from complications caused by radiation and chemotherapy. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's very good to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Well, so thank you very much for being willing to share your time with us. I imagine you feel peaks and valleys as you're recuperating.
Well, I've come light years. You know, I nearly died twice from the complications from radiation and chemotherapy, diagnosed originally about a year ago, last April. And that process was a kind of a shamanic death in itself.
Yeah, I imagine.
And close to a real-time death. But it's been quite a journey, and I grow stronger every day. And unfortunately, my first post-treatment biopsy tested benign, at the tumor site. But unfortunately, a recent biopsy tested positive for some malignancy. So I'm still kind of processing that.
Mm. Wow. So I imagine that your shamanic work and your connection to spirit is fundamental in the process that you're using to accommodate and cope with this experience.
Oh, no doubt about it. And plus, I feel that the tangible effects of shamanic practitioners and other spiritually minded people and prayer networks and everything working remotely on my behalf, there are times when I feel the, the waves of energy, or I feel the visitations as people are sending their spirit healers and power animals or simply praying, on my behalf. It's very moving. It's very beautiful, actually.
I think the idea of being supported, of being held by spirit and by others, is something that we all think about, but I don't know that we very often actually feel it as deeply as you are feeling it, perhaps.
Well, that might be true. I mean, from my own standpoint, I'm not I'm used to be on the giving end, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, reciprocity is very important in shamanism, as it is in, you know, living a whole and healthy life. But, you know, I'm an artist. I've kind of lived on the edge of the village most of my life. As I grew a little older, and it became less graceful to, you know, put freelance and live on the edge of that village, I made some inroads and began working on the front lines of social services. So I've usually been on the giving end of, you know, social services and human services. So it's quite, it's been quite a surrender to just allow myself to be taken care of, you know.
Yeah.
Not only remotely, but, you know, while I was in the hospital, I was in the hospital for almost, for over 3 months.
Wow.
And here in Minneapolis, and I never had much experience with the healthcare system. It's a huge industry, and I could criticize it for days, but I certainly couldn't criticize the caregivers that worked with me in the hospital. They were all who were motivated by an altruistic impulse, and I just got the most incredible care, the most loving, you know, beautiful care from the nurses, the nurses' aides, the doctors, and you know, really, really remarkable. And so, you know, the truth is that you know, no one really knows the time of their death. I mean, there may be some rare people, a monk in Tibet, or you know, a developed shaman who sees that moment of their death coming. But most of us don't know the time of their death or the moment of their death. But one thing we do know is that the older we get, the closer to that moment we come. We become, you know. So
yeah.
I'm 65 years old. My cancer, according to my oncologist, is incurable. It's also inoperable because I had so much damage in that area from the radiation and chemotherapy.
Mm.
But I believe in miracles, you know. And with or without a miracle, I believe that that this is a call, you know, to just, you know, live my life more fully, more hopefully, more authentically, you know, shed, you know, what's not so important and, you know, focus on what is.
Yeah.
Work on myself so when that moment of death comes, I'm as free from anger and resentment as I can be, and so I can meet that moment in a good way, you know.
Well, I think we're all being called to understand and develop a relationship with death. And I say that because so much of the old structures that we have lived under that have brought us to this moment are collapsing.
Yay, yippee!
Yeah, it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.
Yes.
Well, the key is to really feel fine, right? I mean, it is a challenging time, and death doesn't always, you know, we don't always respect death and accommodate death without struggle. And I think there, you know, that's the general story with things that are living and things that have motion, is that they want to keep going. And so we're facing this time when those of us who have experiences with death, metaphorically or even close brushes with the real thing,
mm-hmm.
have a special wisdom to offer everybody else, because we're all going to be faced with structures, processes, and relationships in our lives with things that are dying. And not small things either. Big things, big elements of our culture.
Well, our culture is sick, you know, it has to be, you know, reformed and for us to survive, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, all of the, you know, ecologists, most of the environmentalists, you know, agree. Some of them actually feel that it's too late, but
Well, that's, you know, that's the other thing I personally have a real challenge with. And that is that not only are the old, decrepit, and unhealthy things going to die, but many of the beautiful and lovely things may also die. And to be prepared to grieve and to weep for the loss of the precious and innocent that are going to, that, you know, inevitably get caught up in this grinder of
of radical change that we're going to go through.
Or in shamanism, the idea of dismemberment, when it's taken apart and put back together and remembered in a new way is so important. Mm. And then related to, talking about, death, whether actual or metaphorical, it's, my original call to shamanism came from a kind of a near-death experience. It was.
I actually wanted to ask you. I was just going to ask you about that. I'm glad we led right into it.
Well, I was barely out of high school. It was the summer after I graduated from high school in 1965. I was living in Southern California in a pretty conservative community, Orange County, Fullerton, California. And through a series of circumstances, I was offered a dose of LSD. It was a pure Sandoz laboratory LSD. And it was a little prior to, the emergence of Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert and, the whole movement of, turn on, tune in, drop out. That was, soon to follow. But, I knew nothing about LSD. I hadn't the clue as to what it might do to me. Mm. And I took it and with this gentleman, and we were kind of driving around. And then we decided to stop by a friend of mine who was having kind of a small party. Mm. And I was feeling kind of a little odd, and we stopped into the party. And
a little odd?
Well, just a little odd, premonitions. But we went into the party, and everything just seemed so overwhelming, the loud, rock and roll music and everything. And I looked at my hand, and I suddenly realized that it was shriveling away. And I tried to shake it off, and I thought, oh, my God, what is going on? And I tried to shake it off, but I couldn't. My arm began to, shrivel almost into a skeleton. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm dying. And then the thought came to me, well, if I'm dying, I want to be someplace more peaceful. So I went out into the backyard, away from the loud noise and the, drinking and the carrying on. And I lay down on a chaise lounge and underneath an orange tree. And I proceeded to disintegrate. Literally, I dissolved into a skeleton. I skeletonized.
Mm.
And I had kind of a bi-local awareness. I was looking outside of my skull, and at the same time, I had a overview looking down on top of my body. And I began to dissolve into kind of a molecular field of white light and then a clear light. And I became attuned to the suffering on the planet. Mm. Not just my suffering, but our human suffering, but just the innate suffering of sentient beings on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And my heart was just opened up in a way that I can't, it's kind of impossible to describe. And of course, in an indigenous culture, if someone had an experience like this, they'd have medicine people or elders to go into to make some sense and bring some context to an experience like this. But it took me some years to integrate it. And then I began to, learn about through, literature like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, for example, or, that there are, precedent for this kind of an experience.
Mm.
And everything that preceded or that occurred in the aftermath, was this, big experience, behind it. And then, of course, the whole counterculture unfolded, turn on, tune in, dropped out, which I did. And I continued to want to re-experience that. And so I continued to take LSD, and I didn't always have the best experiences after that. And then finally, a wonderful older man who I shared this experience with and helped me kind of integrate as an artist in San Francisco by the name of Liam O'Gallagher said to me, he said, well, Stephen, once you've seen God once, do you have to see God again? and I realized that it was a kind of, that I'd been enmeshed in kind of a spiritual greed wanting to re-experience this, ecstatic experience.
Hmm. That's actually an interesting perspective, and I guess once you see God once, you realize how ecstatic it is, and so you want to go back to that place. But maybe a good question is why do we want to go back to that place other than to feel the ecstasy? And what can we do instead that, we, you know, what do we get from that experience that leads us forward to something else? So how did that experience, that ecstatic experience, shift you? What was the consequence of that?
Well, I could never look at the world in the same way again, you know, because in, no matter what was going on in the midst of the most mundane, you know, I'd torn that fabric, you know, of, between, you know, our ordinary conditioned reality and an archetypal kind of, you know, experience of the infinite and the. So I was never able to live life quite the same way again. In my own case, you know, my recreational use of drugs and alcohol and so forth progressed, and I eventually got into recovery. And
so you went down pretty low.
I did. Mm-hmm.
And this was without this was post ecstatic experience, but pre-shamanic training.
Correct. Yep, okay. Absolutely. Because I supplemented my 12-step, you know, recovery with therapy, and I, luckily, because I'd always had a interest in Carl Jung and his, you know, window on psychology and spirituality, I chose a wonderful Jungian psychologist who, you know, worked with dreams and so forth, and it was actually my psychotherapist, Donald Kilhefner, who suggested that I take the introductory course with Michael Harner, you know, the Way of the Shaman, you know, the kind of this like, gatekeeping door opener, you know, for all the other workshops that the Foundation for Shamanic Studies offers. So,
and what was the impact of that on you?
Well, it was wonderful because it, first of all, it started to it educated me to the fact that I'm not alone. You know, that there have been people who have been called to spiritual work expressed in this form, you know, for ages. That as exotic as shamanism might sound, it's, you know, fairly easily learned. Some people may be more gifted than others, but there are, you know, tools, you know, that have been practiced, you know, cross-culturally for millennia, and they are very easily taught. And so it gave me a vehicle, you know, to express and practice, you know, that spiritual dimension in a way that was not only of service to myself and my own healing, but eventually, you know, the healing and service of others and their community. So.
So how old were you when you took the Way of the Shaman? Roughly.
Gosh. Oh, I wish I were better at linear time, but mm-hmm. Let's see. It must have been maybe around 1990.
Okay.
That's a guess.
Yeah. You had lived a fair amount of time in the world as without it.
Yes, without, you know, the formal study of shamanism. However, you know, as a, you know, a hippie turning on, tuning in and dropping out, I did what a lot of young people did at the time, and I went on a guru hunt and went shopping for different spiritual schools and disciplines and meditations, and so I was always seeking, you know.
Hmm.
I mean, later in San Francisco, it always kind of bewildered me that people would, you know, take LSD and go off and dance in a disco or something, you know. It just, and of course later I discovered some other psychotropics and, you know, mushrooms and peyote and so forth, but I was always called to kind of work with those medicines in a more sacred way.
Yeah, more sacred way.
In a respectful way.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I can't imagine what it must be like to be in the presence of something so powerful and transcending and use it in such a frivolous way. But maybe it's not frivolous. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it's not. I mean, after all, there's nothing wrong with people just enjoying themselves, you know, and if that's the tool for them to do that, it just, for me being who I am, you know, and my particular, you know, makeup, it just didn't seem to come with the territory, you know.
Yeah, I hear you. Okay, well, let's take a short break, and then when we come back, I want to hear more about how you have been experiencing shamanism in your life since then, and what additional studies you've embraced and so on. So we'll be right back.
Sounds good.
We hope you're enjoying today's program. You can find archives of A Shamanic Life and our other thoughtful and provocative programs at blogtalkradio.com/fireflywillowslive. Check out Convergence, John's monthly radio magazine where science and mysticism meet, the third Sunday of every month. Or one of our other interesting shows and their interesting hosts, blogtalkradio.com/fireflywillowslive. Come join us.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. My guest today is Stephen Guy Solberg, and we're talking about his path into shamanism, and we're going to hear a little bit more about the different different techniques and folks with whom Stephen has studied. So, Stephen, you mentioned something to me on the break about working with a Shoshone teacher.
By the name of Clyde Hall. Clyde inherited the mantle of the Naraya, which is the Shoshone version of the ghost dance.
Oh.
And he inherited the mantle from his Auntie M, who was the keeper of that bundle. And Clyde inherited it, and he wanted to reintroduce it to the Shoshone people. But they weren't interested, actually. There's been so much damage, you know, post colonization, you know, for North American indigenous peoples, and who was very interested, and I don't know exactly what year this was a lot of hippies and ex-hippies, you know, who he brought the Naraya to. It's a dance that one does holding hands around a tree, and oftentimes during the course of the dance, participants are, you know, taken away by spirit. You know, you literally kind of fall out of the group and get taken by spirit into a non-ordinary state of reality. Hmm. And that was definitely kind of a living shamanic tradition, you know.
Hmm.
I think about some of those exercises we did in Michael Harner's three-year program, one of which, you know, everybody kind of fell down into a altered state of reality. We lost consciousness on one level and awakened on another. And a lot of similar kinds of things would occur to people when they were involved in the Naraya. Also, I witnessed another something similar. You know, my domestic partner is Native American. He's Ho-Chunk.
Mm-hmm.
Ho-Chunk means the people of the big voice, and they're very ancient people, actually. They're the mother tribe of the Dakota and the Sioux people here in the Midwest and the Plains.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And a big part of our move back to Minneapolis was Cole's desire to get back in the mix of his tribe, his language, renew his connection to his traditional ceremonial life. And we did. We did a lot of that, but unfortunately it ended up being kind of disillusioning for him, because a lot of the men in his tribe were very homophobic.
Oh.
And that wasn't always true. In most indigenous cultures, you know, the two-spirited people, or who we would call GLBTQ people, were highly revered. They were often, you know, medicine people. They were usually looked to for counseling because they understood both the psyche of men and women.
Mm.
Often taken as good luck on war parties, always included in councils.
Yeah.
Usually really good craftspeople. I mean, think of the number of GLBT people, you know, who are artists, you know. And in a non-monetary culture, you know, where people, you know, trade things, you know, that was very valued. So.
Yeah. So, that must have been very kind of disheartening for him.
It was. It was very disheartening, but he needed to learn that, you know. And You know, it's just one of the facts of what happened to, and we often think of the American Indian culture, but, there isn't an American Indian culture. There are hundreds of tribes.
Yeah.
And each tribe has its own culture, even though they may share certain values, such as respect for the environment or reciprocity in terms of the, not taking more than you, give to the environment. So it was very disillusioning and saddening for Cole. In fact, he's writing a piece about it. It's going to be called The Last Verdash. The Verdash is actually a name that the French colonists described to people that they saw cross-dressing. They weren't Verdash. That was a French name, but each tribe had their own name for such people. But in Cole's tribe, the last documented two-spirited person was named Blue Lake Woman. And he's going to write a play about Blue Lake Woman, his last two-spirit who lived openly before having to go underground. A lot of those people had to go underground anyway because of the colonists, when they saw, what standing the two-spirited people had in their community, they would target them, to eliminate them, because they would go after the heart and soul of the tribe, because all the easier to subjugate them. And, there are periods in our history when, Indian peoples, were forbidden to speak their own language. They had their hair cut. They were stolen from their families and forced into boarding schools where they were punished severely if they tried to practice their ways and or even spoke their own language. It's kind of a shadow side of American history that we often forget. But
or aren't really taught.
No, we certainly aren't,
It's a terrible tragedy it's a terrible tragedy that it happened. But it's even more, I shouldn't say even more, it is also a deep tragedy that we don't see that as a valuable thing to teach about who we are as a people and what happened to those who were here before. Because our estrangement
from the natural world
is, it almost feels to me like in order for us to heal that estrangement, we have to recognize that that's what we did to the people that were here who were not estranged from the natural environment.
No, I think you're absolutely right. There needs to be reconciliation from both ends. And because, even today, most Indian peoples, suffer from multi-generations of post-traumatic stress. There's so much. I mean, anthropologists will point out that these First Nations people and Indigenous people say, the primitives, but primitive, what the heck are we talking about? I mean, no homelessness, perfect, harmony with the environment, no pollution.
Social Security, all taken care of, right?
Yeah.
The elderly were never abandoned.
No, in fact, the elderly were highly revered. And we have so much to learn, in terms of the, nothing would be acted upon without considering how it might affect, the generations in the future.
Right. And a lot of those tribes had a strong role for women.
Oh, absolutely. The clan mothers. I mean, Cole's tribe is pretty matriarchal. His mother was a clan mother, and boy, she rules the roost.
Yeah.
It was wild, though. I mean, we got involved in the mix enough, and I would ask Cole what was going on, and he said, I grew up with all this stuff, and it's still a mystery to me. But we would, be involved in a munkaun, or their medicine dance, for example, which is actually the medicine lodge is a initiatic lodge. It's an inner circle, and then the outer circle, and people would come out of the lodge at certain points, in kind of an altered state, you could tell, and they would be pursued by the medicine man who was holding an otter pelt. And as soon as he would touch somebody with the otter pelt, boom, they would fall right down on the ground, taken by spirit into some other realm. And then there were times when we would go to winter feasts, and I would just kind of follow what everyone else was doing in terms of the ritual and the ceremony and the different movements and the different kinds of dances and so forth, but they would bring out, you know, bundles, you know, for that particular clan, whoever was hosting the feast, and open up these bundles that were like thousands of years old. And the energy that would come out of these bundles. You know, I didn't understand it, but just to be witnessing something that had transpired, you know, over centuries and time in a kind of an uninterrupted way, I felt so privileged and humbled, you know, to be there on one hand, and also I felt so impoverished in a way because, you know, I've never had that.
Because we don't have that. Yeah, and that's exactly where I think this is so important to realize that recognizing what happened to the native peoples as a result of the colonial imperialist empire building thing that occurred here, and not just here, all across the world. It's not about assigning blame or compelling the experience of guilt. It's about recognizing the blindness and seeing what was lost. Because, you know, if we don't actually reconcile just how crazy we as Europeans were, we're missing a very important healing lesson about the nature of blindness, the nature of whatever it was. I would call it arrogance, but there's probably lots of other names for it and lots of other ways to look at it, you know?
Yeah, no, you're right. It's a kind of arrogance, because after all, the colonists came with this principle of manifest destiny. They thought that everything they laid their eyes on belonged to them and was theirs to exploit, you know?
Was theirs to exploit, and worse, they were blind to what it was they were exploiting. So they lost the potential to harvest and harness so much of what was there. Because as you say, we don't have any of those experiences. We don't have the opportunity to be nurtured by the dust of the bones of our ancestors. We don't have the opportunity to participate in a truly sacred ritual that's thousands of years old, unless you count communion, going to church. But, you know, humbly, I suggest that it's not the same thing. And so we impoverished ourselves through our arrogance and blindness. And recognizing and understanding that happened, realizing the depth of that impoverishment is what we're missing, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's the big soul loss.
Yeah, it's big soul loss. You're right.
It's the universal soul loss. You know, we all have individuals, you know, have various degrees of soul loss or disassociation, and but there's a big soul loss, you know, that is just a part of the fabric of our existence, because we... it's just there, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think, and this brings me back to the particulars of the two-spirited people, right? And how they have played such a complex role in much of our culture. They're, you know, being a two-spirit, you know this certainly better than I, because I'm not a two-spirit. The role, the artistry, the aesthetic gifts, the empathy, I think, that comes through when you are in a place where you're not like everybody else. You're not like the majority of people. You have feelings that are not like the majority of the people. And you have to reconcile yourself to that nature that is different. And in the process of reconciling yourself and going through that really long process of self-examination, I think you have a tendency to uncover some pretty serious gifts.
Well, I think one of the principal gifts is that, and this is certainly isn't just exclusive to Two-Spirit people, but it's just, but there's a big distinction between someone walking, through the world in a subject-subject state of consciousness rather than a subject-object state of consciousness. A subject-subject state of consciousness, when it identifies and empathizes, and there's a melding of the a groking, so to speak, between the perceiver and the perceived, as well as that perceived perceiving and perceiving the perceiver, so to speak.
Right, right.
Whereas a subject-object state of consciousness, we objectify things that shouldn't be objectified because we're denigrating the livingness, the living spirit of the material world, and everything is living, including something as concrete as a stone.
Mm.
Let alone a living plant or a four-legged or a two-legged or a winged creature or a human being. I mean, it's everything is alive,
And the subject versus subject object construct, where is that from? Is that a Jungian concept?
No, that is a the first person I heard it from was Harry Hay, who's considered the father of the gay liberation movement.
Well, I think it's very interesting and very powerful because empathy, right, which springs from a subject viewpoint, allows you to share. I think it empowers you to share the experience of someone else in a way that is really illuminating, and it is a way of bridging the gap from our experience of the world as in duality to that experience of the world as oneness.
And we learn that in shamanism, when we learn to merge, with our power animals, our spirit helpers, our patience, if we happen to be, healing,
Right, right.
So I mean, there's an example, and that certainly isn't unique to two-spiritedness, but certainly in shamanism, we're always, forging, a subject-subject state of consciousness, and we're always, expanding that. And
so how have you used your shamanic training over the most recent set of years, the last 10 years or so? Where do you bring it to bear as a skill and a gift?
Well, when I was in Los Angeles, I built a practice. And I, not only that, but I was teaching, workshops that I developed with Dr. Donald Kilhepner. I had people come, and I would, some people just wanted to be the recipients of, healing or divination or so forth. But most I would try to, teach them the basic tools of journey work so that they wouldn't have to depend on me, but could at least, do some rudimentary work on their own if they chose to.
Mm.
So the past few years has been a lot of experiential, based upon some of my experience with Cole and his tribe.
Mm. Yeah.
A lot of it, living even more closer to, a death walk, with my cancer diagnosis and my nearly losing my life twice, and my kind of climb back in terms of strength. And
okay.
And I've done a lot of service here in Minneapolis. I worked as a house manager for a drug and alcohol rehab program for a while, and then I worked as a counselor for an organization called Avenues for Homeless Youth.
You have a project that you are working on. So let's talk a little bit about that. Standing on the Bones of Our Ancestors, Exploring the Role of the Queer Tribal Elder.
Right. Yes, I inherited that project. Actually, I was originally a subject of the documentary, and the producer Donald Hamm died suddenly, and the director Lee Wind got frustrated that he wasn't raising money as quickly as he'd like to work on the project. So he gave what tapings they'd done to me. I continued to work on the piece. And the premise is that the GLBT community is poised in kind of a unique position. We're about four generations since the Stonewall Rebellion in New York City, which is sometimes earmarked as the beginning of the modern-day gay liberation movement. Since the Stonewall Rebellion, you know, entire communities have, you know, come out and living openly, you know, and there are now four generations of openly identified GLBT people. So what happens to those of us who are growing into the realm of old age, like myself? Do we just retire behind a gated community someplace if we're, you know, privileged and fortunate enough to do that, or end up in a single occupancy dwelling someplace if we're impoverished? How did our ancestors revere their elders? How does the health of a community depend on intergenerational relationship? Mm. How can the wisdom of the elders be useful and valuable to younger generations? Elders traditionally would keep the adults in mind, making sure that they're bringing sustenance to the tribe and mentoring the younger people. But also, elders would grow the spiritual dimensions of the young people just by bathing their qualities and their talents in the light of their, attention and their being.
Mm, right.
No decisions would be made without the blessing of an elder in an indigenous culture. And all of our ancestors revered their elders. So it's kind of a big theme. And I'll tell you, if I'd known what it was going to take to finish this documentary, I never would have started.
Filmmaking is a lot of work.
But I have all my media. I've edited to a really pretty good rough cut, and I'm really poised to work with the master editor and bring it home. But the other thing that it does is it explores the spiritual dimension of what it means to be GLBTQ. You know, oftentimes people would say, the only difference between, heterosexual people and homosexual people is what they do in bed. But I would argue that that's one of the few things that are similar. You know, GLBT people do, carry, some anthropologists say that we carry the altruistic impulse. You know, we're often on the leading edge of culture, you know. You think about the designers, the Leonardo da Vinci's, the Michelangelo's, the modern-day fashion designers.
Certainly the front edge of art is often, art and culture is often stocked with LGBT people, yeah.
Do you know the Navajo people, recognize five different genders in their culture, and none of them genders have to do with who a person wants to have sex with.
Really?
It has to do what they're drawn to do in the community, what innate gifts and talents they have, and how they express those in the roles they take in the community.
Wow.
And I think there's so much more to being GLBT than what we do with our sexual organs. You know, it's a state of being. There's not better, not higher, none of those things, but just distinctly different.
Mm-hmm.
And in a culture as homophobic as ours, it's impossible even for someone who strives for liberation, as I have in my whole life, I still carry the remnants of internalized homophobia. It's impossible not to,
Yeah.
It's impossible to be fully who we should be and could be and are intrinsically, I think.
Well, I think the good news is that thanks to the leadership of you and the folks that have come before you and the folks that are still carrying the banner, that you've, as elders you're passing the torch to,
mm-hmm.
Standing
on the bones of our ancestors.
Standing on the bones of our ancestors. Eventually, change happens. So, okay. Well, so we're just about out of time, Stephen. Is there anything, any other thoughts you want to share with our listeners?
Oh, gosh. The only thoughts I might have is that I'd like to extend my wishing for just blessings being showered on the friends and loved ones of your listeners.
Oh, well, that's very sweet of you, I'm sure we'll all gratefully accept that.
and may the spirit that set the heavens in motion, the Creator that set the heavens in motion, guide and protect us and give us, the strength to heal this planet. If in fact we are in a transformational phase when things are, you know, disintegrating and falling apart. Let's, you know, let's pray for the strength and the guidance to reform things in a way that is just more whole and healthy, you know, for all living beings.
Mm. Thank you. Thank you so much. And if people want to get in touch with you to inquire more about your work, what's the best way for them to reach you?
Well, I have a website up for my documentary.
Okay.
Which is standingonthebones.com.
Standingonthebones.com.
Yes.
All right.
And email, you're welcome to email me, is pumaspiritrising@yahoo.com.
pumaspiritrising@yahoo.com.
And I'm happy to communicate with anyone who'd like to contact me. I look forward to it.
Great. All right. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck with your move to L.A. and the progress with your health.
And yes.
Thank you so much for joining us on A Shamanic Life.
And we will stay in touch, Tom.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Okay. Bless you.
Bless you.
Do you have a workshop, protocol, or modality that you'd like to explore with our audience? Come and join us on the air. Share why you love it, how it helps us shine, and empowers us to live more fully. Share your inspiration. You never know who might be listening and whose lives you'll touch. Contact John Carosella on Facebook or by email at jc@fireflywillows.com for details.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. And with me is visionary artist, creativity coach, and shamanic practitioner Annette Wagner for part four of the vision plan. And this time we're going to talk about the dream.
Yes.
All right. So Annette, give us some context and take us out.
So sometimes I call this panel Big Dream. We all have a dream somewhere down in our heart that is the thing we yearn for. It's our heart's desire, it's something that motivates us, but sometimes we also don't articulate it. So what this panel is about articulating that dream. And one way to think about this panel is that this is the container that holds your passion, your purpose, your legend. It's the container that holds all of those other things. And the way it holds it is, it's the connection to spirit, if you will. So if you think about it, if you have a dream and you know that you're living your dream, sometimes people will say things like they feel like their spirit soars, like their spirit takes wing, and it becomes so big that it can encompass everything that you need to do in the world. So one way you can think about this is if you were to finish the sentence, I'm dreaming of a world that, or I'm dreaming of a world in which I, or I'm dreaming that, I mean, just, you don't even have to say the world.
Right, right.
I tend to put those words in there.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about, what is the big dream that pulls you forward?
And do people have those? You know what I mean? Like, is it challenging for people to connect to a dream like that, that is true? I mean, you know, we can all come up with a dream, you know,
right?
But it doesn't necessarily feel like the fabric, that the deep, true fabric of what our soul yearns for.
Sometimes it is a journey to pull this out. You have to tug on the red thread and tug on it and follow it down, and you have to search and figure out what's connected to it. Sometimes it's closer to the surface. It depends a little bit on what kind of vision plan you're doing, whether you're visioning your life or you're visioning a project.
Right.
So, for example, I have this little vision plan in front of me that I did, which is about, so let me give you an example of passion and then dream.
Okay.
I'll give you so I wrote on my panel for passion and calling that my calling is to create containers of opportunity for people to connect to their innate creativity.
Okay.
And my dream is to heal our connection to our creativity and shift how we live our lives so we are in connection with each other and our planet and our earth. Now, so this vision plan, which is around really my teaching, the dream and the passion are connected to each other. And it's like what I'm doing is taking the passion and I'm taking up-leveling it. And I'm bringing in my spiritual connection and saying, what is my soul connection here to this purpose that I'm saying I have in the world? Okay. That's one way to approach it, is to think about your purpose in the world. Sometimes doesn't actually bring, sometimes it doesn't always use the words of spirit in it when you articulate it. Dream is where you can bring that in. It's more, if you will, it's larger than you. It's the container that's larger than you that says, this is how I fit my purpose into the rest of what's going on in the world. That's one way. Another way is you can say, this is my heart's desire. Like, the reason I'm pursuing this passion is. Right?
Okay, so the dream is, you're doing your thing, and this is what happens when you're doing your thing.
Yeah, this is the implications, this is the result, this is what, like, my dream is that if I do this, that this is the impact I'm going to have in the world. So what we do is we articulate that impact and we phrase it in such a way, and this is why many times I actually draw birds with wings and I put things and the bird is carrying things, is because we articulate it as this soaring spirit energy that's going to take our purpose out into the world and connect it to things. It's the reason we're doing the work. It's the thing that sustains our spirit and our soul.
So I kind of hinted at one potential challenge area, which is that people might not be able to describe that. They know what they want to do, maybe, in their passion, but they're not exactly sure what that manifests in the world. Not their personal, not their rewards, not their abundance or anything like that, but what am I actually doing this for?
Right.
And I can imagine also that it's difficult to let go of ego in describing the dream in both directions, right?
Yes.
It's probably very easy to create a strongly self-aggrandizing dream, right?
Yes.
But that doesn't feel real.
Right.
Right. But it's also probably when you actually try to give voice to what's really there, it might seem too big for who you really are, who you really feel you are.
Yes, and that actually tends to be one of the, that's the path that many people actually unconsciously follow and then shut it down.
Right.
Because this is what we're talking about here, is connecting to what my teacher, Shiloh Sophia McLeod, calls our soul work. We're talking about heart's desire. We're talking about those deep inside things that many times are suppressed and submerged, and they're hidden inside of us because we're afraid to show them, because they'll look like they're too big, or they'll look like they're impossible, or they'll look like they're, you know, like they're crazy.
Right.
So sometimes dream is hard to bring out and put onto the panel, which is why sometimes we tell it as a story, or we answer it as a, you know, this is why I feel I'm called to do that, this. And many times what we do on this panel is we start with symbol first. And start with symbol, we start with words, and then we start to bring out the story. And sometimes we also use the third person on this panel, too, where we'll say, her dream is.
Why that? Why the third person? What does that do?
Sometimes that gives people a little bit of a distance. Where, and it also can sometimes set the ego aside just a little bit, is to say it in the third person, like once again, like we did with Legend, where you're the fly on the wall, and you're that one we were saying, you're at a cocktail party and 5 years from, you know,
right,
2 years down the road, and somebody's telling the story of John, right? In the dream one, you could even think about it as being, it's as if you're in a dream, and you're observing, and she has, you know, she is dreaming of a world in which people are connected to the Mother Earth. You know, she is. And you can start to follow threads like that. This one's much softer in the sense of, this is not a panel that you approach in a practical sense. This is something that you approach by moving into that right brain, left brain balance and being much more in the present moment. And this is one that is potentially, I have to say, potentially a little bit more difficult to do on your own and not within the container that we create when we do our workshops.
Oh.
Because I find that when somebody is concerned about this one, and I have them in the container of a workshop, especially with a group setting, they'll get to this one and they'll at least get some part of it.
Right.
And because they're in that context of that other creative energy that we've set up for the workshop, and we are very clear, especially I'm very clear when I set up the containers for my workshops, you know, there's a lot of preparation that goes in to make sure that the space is really there.
Yeah.
And people will get there because they're doing passion and legend and they already have painted backgrounds and started to put symbols on it. When they move into this, things will come out.
Mm.
It may not be everything, but the door will begin
to open. And I get the sense, too, that that as you've described it, you said it's less practical.
Yes.
But it's also, and it's also less concrete.
Yes.
There's no boundaries on this one.
No.
You know, it's sort of like just.
Thank you. That's another way to look at it. There are absolutely no boundaries. We're not trying to write down something here that we think we're going to implement. You know, for example, this is a dream. It may or may not come true in this lifetime. That's okay. That actually has no bearing on the dream. The idea is to put the dream down and bring it in as a container that enables, that begins to hold the other parts.
That's really, I think, that's a really important point. The dream doesn't have to be something that comes true in this lifetime. It's just that you allow yourself the freedom to experience that place.
And when you do that, the other key to this is you bring in a power source by doing that. Because by connecting to the dream and bringing the energy of the dream in here, you're bringing that energy, that dreaming energy that can motivate us and fire up our spirit and keep us going, you're bringing that in and manifesting it as part of your vision plan.
Mm. So what is the emotional attitude or alignment that you find most productive or most conducive to facilitating this dream thing coming out on paper? You know, like where do you take people?
So sometimes when we get to this point, I will, it depends on the group of people that I have, but sometimes I will ask them to think about being held in the arms of spirit or deity. And that they're asleep and they're dreaming.
That would be a good one.
Right, to just take them literally into a place of, okay, you're dreaming. You know, you have this passion, this purpose. And usually at this point, we also have, I will go through the panels with them and at least get backgrounds and symbols kind of drawn. And this is usually at the place where we're going back through and we're starting to add story and word onto the panels. And if they feel like they're stuck, there's a way of just going back into the visioning that we had done, but also thinking about you're held. So that means you're in a safe place, and you're in a safe place spiritually, and just go into your own heart and dream. You know, what wants to come through, and just open the door.
And I think an important aspect of that is that you're held and you're safe.
Yes.
So that you can let go of your need to protect, support, sustain, and or brace yourself.
And give yourself, it's hard in our culture to give ourselves permission to really allow ourselves to dream our dream. I mean, I came from a background where I got told at 5 years old that you never want to go off and be an artist. And I took that dream of being an artist and shoved it way down inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I always had this dream in the back of my head of I wanted to have a show at an actual gallery, you know, that was like this dream that this five-year-old had of having a show at a gallery and standing in the middle of the gallery and seeing my art hanging around me and having people there. And last summer that happened, right? And I remember about 2 weeks before the show opened, standing there in the middle of July, looking around me going, oh my God, I actually have a dream coming true. And if you don't give yourself permission to dream the dream, you never open the door for anything to manifest, right?
Mm.
But to get to the place you can do that, you have to be safe. You have to feel like spirit is holding you. You have to feel like it's okay to dream your dream.
Yeah.
the rewards of doing it, I think, are amazing and immense, even if the entire dream never manifests in your lifetime. And now I happen to be someone who believes that we have more than one life, actual physical one of these lifetimes.
Right.
So I believe that by bringing the dream in and starting to manifest it and creating, taking the panel on our vision plan and turning it into an actual door that the dream starts to come through, that means we're bringing it more present in these lives that we live.
Mm-hmm.
And it does have more opportunity to actually come true when you do that.
These techniques are mystical and magical and so completely incomprehensible that they can have power, and yet they do. And I think I just enjoy that so much, that there are all these different ways of engaging that which is usually unseen.
And yet
it's actually really accessible. The stuff is actually accessible.
Yeah, it's very accessible. And this is what I think people are surprised by when we sit down and we work on these kinds of things, is that it really is just there. It's not like I'm teaching a workshop where I'm telling you what to put on the paper. People come in and they start to create one of these, and all of the images and all of the words and all of the things that come through are coming right out of their heart. And the paper becomes this altar that they're capturing on. And that becomes this incredibly powerful thing. So it's this process of going in with our right and our left brain and being in sacred space and connecting in and doing this work is, I think, just, it's very important to make us whole people.
Mm. That's fantastic. Once again, a great description of the process, and mirrors or is complementary to my personal experience with this panel when I did this work with Annette 2 weeks ago, and it is still unfolding. It's still unfolding, and you know, I still have a lot of work to do on my vision plan, but it actually is creating shifts. That, you know, stuff is happening.
Yes, and that's one of the wonderful things about these, and is that they continue to manifest and. You go back and you look at them and you go, oh, right, I did that.
Yeah.
Oh, that, it's happening.
Right.
Which is why I think next time is going to be even more fun. Is dream is one that'll, it's like it puts this little web of filaments into everything else that we do. And one of the things that we're going to talk about next time that becomes a big piece of that is beloveds. We're going to talk about who we serve in the world and who our beloveds are. And then we'll be at the end of these four panels. I think people will be able to see how they all come together and support each other.
Sounds great. All right. Annette, thanks so much for joining us again, and we'll see you next time. Talk about beloveds.
Yes, we will.
All right. Thanks. And we'll be right back. Ah, the journey. It's fundamental to shamanism. If you've had a journey that made a difference in your life and you feel called to share it, consider sharing it with us. In Tales from the Road, we offer the surprising stories and insights that come from your journeys with the power to change lives. Of course, respect your power. Share only as you're called to. If you're interested, contact me, John Carosella, by email at jc@fireflywillows.com. Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. Next up, I have a very special guest. Excuse me. Ana Maria Sanchez holds a master's degree in counseling psychology and is a holistic counselor and founder of Free the Light Within. Her desire to help others has its roots in the trauma she suffered as a victim of childhood sexual abuse. And for 10 years, Ana Maria had a career in conventional mental health until she was no longer able to ignore the inner pain she'd been repressing and could no longer escape it with alcohol or drugs. Her lack of self-esteem resulted in even more abuse and unhappiness as she found herself in a series of volatile domestic relationships. With the pain came repressed memories, and Ana Maria entered her dark night of the soul, which would eventually lead her to a period of growth, healing, and spiritual renewal. Her quest for healing became her lifelong passion, transforming her into the joyful survivor she is today. Ana Maria is a compassionate healer, providing a depth of understanding that comes from personal experience of pain, self-sabotaging behaviors, healing, and even the setbacks that challenge us as we peel away the layers of our wounds to reveal the beauty of our precious inner spirit.
Anna Maria is the best-selling author of Girl from the Hood Gone Good, One Woman's Mission to Help Others Overcome a Pain-Filled Past. She was invited to attend and speak at the 57th Commission on the Status of Women at the United Nations. That is why we've invited her to be with us tonight. Yeah, come to the show. Anna Maria, are you there? Anna Maria, are you there?
John, can you hear me?
I can now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wow. Yeah, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. You went to the United Nations in March, right?
It was just recently. It was just a month ago in New York.
Yeah. And how did you manage to find yourself there? How did you get invited?
Well, that still perplexes me to this day, but I know that, you know, the universe definitely had a hand in this. In December, just this past December, I attended a networking event. It was a networking event and also a Christmas gathering for a foundation called the Cardia Center, which I support and I've spoken at and done workshops for before. And I really do enjoy this nonprofit. They do a lot for community. So it was a very stormy night. Went to the event in San Jose, thought I would be there for only maybe an hour or so. I was just going to go there to lend my support and then get home quickly because of the storm. But what actually happened was I encountered so many new women that I hadn't met, lovely souls, and connected with them. And one in particular who looked very familiar to me, who turned out to be Marilyn Fowler, the person who invited me to the United Nations after a 45-minute conversation with her. It just happened that quickly and that swiftly. And this was after just networking for 45 minutes and speaking with her and getting to meet with her. And at the end, I went up to give her a hug because she was leaving earlier to catch the train home, back to San Francisco, actually. And I felt compelled. I felt moved by spirit to go up to her and say thank you for all she's done. Now, mind you, the conversation we had never really went deeply into anything that I knew that she had done, but my spirit knew that she had done much for society and much for community. And when I went to go give her a hug, right after the hug, she invited me, would you like to come to United Nations conference, women's conference, with me as a delegate? And my whole body started to shake, and my lower lip started to quiver, and I felt the tears well up, because I knew the impact and the what that meant on a grander level, but my body, my human body was trying to catch up to what a huge honor had just been extended to me.
Yeah, wow. So tell us a little bit about the Cardia Foundation.
The Cardia Foundation is a foundation where in San Jose they work with community to help entrepreneurs and to help community and to help the new entrepreneur find resources and understand what it means to be an entrepreneur and how to run a business from a soulful perspective.
Wow. That sounds like a beautiful organization. And you've been supporting them for how long now?
They've only been around for about a year and a half or so. And, it's since their inception, really.
Well, I know that they're very active in the Bay Area in support of women entrepreneurship, women's leadership, and women's issues. Was that one of the reasons why she invited you to attend?
No, I believe I can't fully answer that, but I believe one of the things she did state was she liked my energy, liked my spunk, and I brought my book, Girl from the Hood Gone Good, as one of my business cards, so to speak. And
right.
And she knew my, by the title itself, Girl from the Hood Gone Good, and 45 minutes of chatting with her, knowing that I was a survivor of domestic violence and that the United Nations conference was all about ending atrocities against women internationally.
So you, how long were you there at the United Nations?
7 days. It's a 2-week conference, and it was, I stayed for 7 full days.
Wow. And what, can you give us a sense for what kind of topic were covered?
Topic that I spoke on was holistic solutions to recovery, to empowering our communities. There were many, many, many workshops going on at once, and many of them were workshops of actual survivors from all around the world, from the Congo, from Afghanistan, from Central America, coming forth to share their stories of survival and to speak on atrocities that are still taking place, unfortunately. And there were panels mainly about that, and also what is yet needing to be done globally so that these laws, many laws have been passed, but they're not being enforced. So many of those panels was the dilemma of what do we as a nation and as a global community do to enforce these laws, to implement them in each country, and to earn the respect and right for all women.
Now, so if you could describe the general intention, the general intention is to enhance the status of women in the world. I guess, like, what are the policies they're seeking to implement? Is it, one of them, I guess, is to get the laws that are on the books enforced. Are there things that they're working on? I can imagine there's probably dozens of policies.
There is dozens of policies, but the main theme, the one number one theme, is the protection of our children, the protection of our women, the common decency and respect to have the right to live, and also to, there's so much sex trafficking going on and rape. And the violations are horrific. And just the right to your personal being, your body, that no one else should have the right to violate.
Well, I think, it leaves me a little bit speechless to contemplate being confronted by the reality of that. Of that aspect of our world and our culture that is broken on the scale that you must have encountered it at the United Nations. It must have been, you were basically surrounded by women who had stories to tell of things that were not good.
Correct. And in all honesty, I was rather ill prepared. I was caught up in the magic of being able to go and share and contribute to change that, ignorantly enough, I did not prepare or think about the magnitude of what I was about to walk into.
Yeah.
20,000 women gathered together in protest along with the survivors of these horrific, of these brutalities, and you are completely enmeshed in this day and night. So ill-prepared prior to going, and quite honestly, my first time there, not enough self-care. And which impacted me on all levels on my return home, and still processing that right now as we speak.
Well, so in a way, it was a trauma.
Yes, It was, I've been invited to come back and speak again. I will do so. I now sit on the board of directors with Marilyn Fowler, with her organization, Women's Intercultural Network, based in San Francisco, and very proud of that. But I am diagnosed with PTSD, with a severity of what I endured throughout my life, and anxiety, and it triggered. And shamanic work that I do and the training that I undergo, as well as the healings that I do in others, this is my gift. This is a gift to me. I understand that. But in the midst of going through it, it feels like a dark night again. It's very painful and very uncomfortable, but yet a revealing to me that more lessons, more healing needs to be done, and how very crucial it is as a healer walking this shamanic lifestyle. It is imperative on a daily basis, no matter where you are at, to carry your medicine and apply it at all times.
Yeah, yeah. We really do have to. If you're going to walk this path, you got to walk. You can't pretend, because you know, we're invited into a place of where healing is needed, and
right.
that calls us to be prepared. You know, it calls us to action, and we need to be in shape, and we need to be maintaining ourselves. I think.
Yeah, there has to be a vigilance. There just has to be. And that, I think, is one of my biggest lessons, was just because I flew into East Coast and left San Francisco Bay Area does not mean that I should have left my mesa, my medicine, my staff back home. You know?
Yeah, yeah. It's that's an interesting. Wow. Well, okay, so Anna Maria, you'll be willing to join us next show to talk a little bit more about your experience and your takeaways, right?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So is there anything else you want to share with us?
I just really want to emphasize for healers who are listening, you know, who we might know this intellectually, but really own it on a heart level and soul level, it is imperative now in our day and age to walk the walk, talk the talk, carry our staff everywhere we go, even in for our dream time. And that was the biggest takeaway for me, and that's something I just want to share with the healers who are listening, as well as any audience. Believe another thing is the audience that's listening, the person who comes to us healers, to understand when you're going to a healer, the healer usually is also dealing with something in their personal life as well. You know, everyone's on the path. Everyone is working on themselves. And many times I think people, and I made this mistake when I used to go to healers, I thought they were, well, not perfect, but I thought that they had it always so together that they couldn't possibly be dealing with any kind of pain as I went to them for. I really believe that, you know. So
yeah,
now at the other end, I'm like, oh.
Well, it is the path of the wounded healer, you know, and
yes,
the wounds that illuminate many of our gifts. So self-care, clarity, all very important aspects of what we do.
Yes.
Well, okay, Anna Maria, if people want to get in touch with you or learn a little bit more about you and your work, how should we direct them?
They can go to my website at www.freethelightwithin.com. That's freethelightwithin.com. And
great.
On there is all my information and videos and classes and direct phone number to get a hold of me.
All right. Excellent. Anna Maria, thank you for joining us on the show tonight. We look forward to having you back and your service to the community and to women's issues and women worldwide.
Thank you so much for having me again, John. I look forward to continuing the talk on the UN.
All right. Thanks, and we'll be right back.
Okay, bye-bye.
Hi, this is John Carosella, your host for A Shamanic Life. I hope you're enjoying the show. I love creating this show and sharing our guests with you. If you'd like to support the show, your contributions in any amount are gratefully received. If you'd like to help, send your contribution via PayPal to asl@fireflywillows.com. That's asl@fireflywillows.com. Sincerely, and with love and light, I thank you.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. And we're here with Gina Carosella for The Sensory Experience. And what have you got for us this time?
Today we have the first of what will probably be a series of still quiet moments. And these are sensory experiences that aren't a particular thing like rosemary or a particular event like Lost Pines at night. These are just taking a moment, being outside, and seeing what's around.
Oh, okay. So these are, in a way, they're very yin, because you're not actually searching or actively experiencing, you're just receiving.
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right, and what do we got?
So today's still quiet moment is a hint of rain at night.
Now, last time you did something about rain.
Yes, last...
It was late winter rain or something.
Late season rain, yes.
Late season rain, right. So how is this different?
Late season rain, I was out for a walk. I was searching out different things. I was exploring a little bit more. This one, I was just letting it happen.
Hmm. Okay. And what did you come away with?
One of the larger features of this particular experience was actually more the wind than the rain.
Oh.
The wind was blowing rather briskly that evening, and so the primary sensory experience for this piece was sound.
Oh, okay. All right, well, that'll be interesting to hear about. Okay, is there anything else you want to share before you actually give us the experience?
No, I think we're good.
All right, so, well then, why don't you share with us a still quiet moment, a hint of rain at night.
A still quiet moment, a hint of rain at night. The breeze is cold, winter not yet surrendering to the creep of the seasons. It plays over my skin, raising goosebumps and drawing out a shiver. The fountain grass hisses as it moves, long golden blades swaying. It seems restless, not like the trees. The pistache tree whispers cheerfully, a few red-orange salmon leaves falling from among the healthy green. The pistache cares little for the changing of the seasons. The great old pine creaks, its joints weary with age, as it grumbles under its breath. Tiny touches of cold fall against my upturned face. One raindrop lands in a perfect kiss upon my lower lip. It is bitter against my tongue, the taste heavy with whatever imperfection called it down from the clouds. The plum blossoms bloom white and bright against the darkness. They shine and twist in the wind, and the bitter brown smell of chartreuse pollen tickles unpleasantly in my nose. There is pollen everywhere, layered on leaves and stones and cars. Bruised purple clouds obscure most of the stars, but a few pinpricks of white shine through. Clear and bright and cold as the wind.
Are you a spiritually inspired musician or performance artist? Join our show for Spirit, Muse, and Song. We'd love to enjoy your work and your story and share it with our audience. Contact us at facebook.com/shamanic life or send a message to Karen Armstrong, K-A-R-Y-N, at shamaniclife.com, or John Carosella, J-C, at fireflywillows.com. We're excited to hear from you.
This is A Shamanic Life, and I'm John Carosella. I am so excited about our next guest. This is the Spirit Muse and Song segment, and with us tonight is Gentle Thunder. Now, Gentle Thunder is a Grammy-nominated performing artist, multi-instrumentalist, musical intuitive, teacher, and visionary who lives in Mount Shasta, California. She has released 4 CDs so far and toured extensively, gathering international audience through diverse musical talent and authentic presence. She now collaborates with mystic Robin Alexis, sharing a joint healing practice. And she, unfortunately for those of us, her fans, taking a hiatus from touring, offer private sessions in person and via the phone worldwide. I've had the pleasure of listening to Gentle Thunder in concert and being with her in ceremony, and I know you'll find her music beautiful and powerful. Let's listen to Ancient Ones from her 2007 album, The Gate. So that was Ancient One from Gentle Thunder's 2007 album, Opening the Gate. Deeply devoted to walking a path of beauty and honoring all life as sacred, Gentle Thunder is tonight to share her music and experience of living a shamanic life. Gentle Thunder, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. It's really good to be here with you and all the listening audience and all our relations.
And all our relations. Yes, yes. And I based on that song, I mentioned that there are a lot of unseen listeners who have showed up just to hear that.
Yes, indeed.
your music is so... it's airy, it's free and open, but it is not trivial. It has a sense of depth, and I'll use the word, it has a sense of power that just draws me right into the place. And you know, that's probably why you're a Grammy nominated artist.
Yeah. Well, thank you. It's a high compliment to be able to have the intention of the prayer behind the music be received and felt, which behind all of my albums I've ever created, there's a constant prayer, even though each album is different and brings a different energy. The constant prayer has always been to be a vehicle to bring the listener back home to the truth of their heart, the truth of their authentic self, to be able to take that deep breath and go, oh, yeah, okay, I remember. I remember what's true. I'm really a magnificent being, and all I need to do is show up and be me, and everything really is okay because we come home to our heart. And for everybody, that's different. For everybody, whatever that means for them is different. But the universal prayer underneath the music I play is that, to bring us home, and it's all way bigger than me. I get to show up and be as clear as I can, be as fine-tuned of an instrument as I can be, and a good listener to spirit, and then let it flow through me and as unadulterated as possible. So thank you for those words and receiving the prayer.
No, well, I indeed have and do every time I listen to your music. So you're, you know, we call this spirit muse and song because there is in the embracing of the music, there's usually something outside of ourselves that we connect to bring that to connect so that something that otherness, that ethereal otherness, can flow into us and through us. What do you have a process that you engage, or a particular kind of ceremony or spirit or ritual that connects you most specifically to your musical muse, or is it just with you all the time?
Great question. You know, I spoke to it briefly in what I shared in the opening there, but it's really about trusting oneself. For me, it's about trusting and cultivating relationship, balance, beauty, connection, source energy with all our relations. And it's from that place of the truth of the oneness that the energy can flow freely. Now, I learned years ago that what was really happening was I was really being played, not puppeted, but played by the spirit of music herself. And there's a practice of showing up, being present, listening, but also getting out of the way enough to allow spirit to just move through me. And I realized many years ago that was really my specialty, and that I actually have the ability to tune in to my environment, a person, a place, a gathering, and to reflect the energy musically, because I will allow myself to be played. And I trust myself enough to know that I'm willing to leap into that void and dive into the unknown. That's very exciting, and sometimes, you know, one can get way out there. However, the truth is, that's the mystery, and that's where the juice is in relationships.
Yeah.
So start with balanced relationship to the oneness first, and then open to what wants to pour forth from the Creator, from love, from music, from the spirit muse.
You know, when we were in ceremony, it was a colleague of ours, Melissa Redding, who led that Buryat tree ceremony. And something that I learned from her, that we had a discussion in our Celtic shamanism program. We were talking about the ego, and we were kind of trashing the ego and bashing the ego. She said, wait just a minute there. Funny. She said, there's the part of the ego which is... you know, maybe the I am part, I am this, I am that, that maybe gets us into trouble. But there's also a part of ego, the I can part, that encourages us to step into our gifts in a way. It's like, for you, I imagine it's I can play the hammer dulcimer, I can play the Native American flute, and I can connect to mystery at the same time. And isn't that a little bit of, isn't there a little bit of you in this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My heart and soul is present in what I do, and that's the part when I speak about showing up fully present and fully in presence, because I speak to it musically and through words when I do events. One of the main things, there's a song actually, one of the first songs I had come through me, created, was called Spirit Fire, and I speak as well as play the prayer every time. The truth that each one of us is part of the one source flame, but each one of us is our own unique essence, and that it is imperative that each one of us shows up to bring our unique flame, our gift. And if we don't, there is no understudy, and our presence and our place just doesn't get brought to the greater life production, if you will. And so, absolutely, I'm in there. My unique essence, my configuration of how Creator wants to express itself through me as gentle thunder this lifetime, it absolutely has to be present for it to be authentic. Mm. And that's why I say I get played, not puppeted, you know, sometimes.
Right, oh, right. Yeah.
There's a big distinction, and you know, sometimes channeling or being a medium, sometimes there's, you know, an energy can come right in and take over as a host. You become a host for an energy.
Right.
And I've experienced that at times to a certain degree, because I will get done with, actually Spirit Fire is one of those, I can get way out there, and when I come back, finish the piece, and I look up into the room I'm in, into the environment, the gathering, sometimes my vision is super blurry because I haven't really fully come back in. Not that necessarily something had taken me over, but
right.
I'm so expanded that it's like, okay, let's get fully back embodied here. And yeah, so it's absolutely both, John. It's
so
both. I'm present
amazing.
And being played. And that's the delicate balance, and that's relationship. You know,
yeah.
We have to show up in balance first to meet all the rest of our life.
Yeah. Now, you said that one of your gifts is to be in the presence of someone or some place or some situation and reflect that situation in music. I imagine that's one of the things that's so powerful about the healing work that you're doing with Robin Alexis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was why it was a natural evolution in the group settings or the events I would do. I was doing it for the collective body, and at some point throughout an evening I would be playing some aspect of your soul essence, and that's why when something really touches someone, it's because it resonates. It's their magnificence is being reflected. And so whenever anybody would say, your music is so beautiful, I say, thank you. And it's really a direct reflection of your magnificence. So, you know, really, really claim it. And so for somebody to embody that beauty that they just experienced is really empowering, but it's really true. And so, yes, the divine appointment to end up working with this mystic, clairvoyant, clairaudient, this medium, channel, Reiki master, shamanic healer, amazing, well-rounded being known as Robin Alexis, and to bring the musical channeling, the musical intuitive, the being able to tune into your soul and what frequencies are needed to be played on what instrument and what needs to be played in any given moment, I have honed my skills and my trust enough to just listen, and it's like, oh, okay, I'm supposed to pull that flute down, and okay, I'm going to play this. And sometimes I'm playing really extreme stuff, and I kind of got to go like, whoa, yeah, I got to trust that this is what their spirit needs right now. But that's part of that trust. And sure enough, in every session, everyone comes out and goes, wow. And the music you played, when you played it, and where you played it, and what you played, it was like perfect every time. And it helped me really anchor in the healing and clear the energy. So absolutely, it is the great utilization of my unique gifts to work specifically with a soul and to have the where two or more gathered energy where me and Robin come together. Each one of us is powerful in our own practice, but together we are the more.
Yeah.
And so it's really beautiful. I'm actually going to be on her radio show tomorrow on Mystic Radio from noon to 1 on KKNW in the Seattle area, of course online, available anywhere. And you can get to that link on my website, gentlethunder.com. But we're going to go give a little taste of, you know, five-minute readings for people who call in. And of course, an hour session is way more profound than a five-minute touch-in, but it'll give folks a sense, and I love it. I love the work. I feel really blessed to be able to do this.
Mm, okay, so we're going to play another piece of your music. We're going to play Summer Solstice, Soulstice. But before we do, if you would, with came to the hammer dulcimer, which is the way one of my favorite instruments of all.
Thank you. Well, I started out as a drummer over 30 years ago, played drums in rock and roll bands in Seattle, and moved down to Memphis to pursue my recording career, and was playing with a band down there for a couple years and pursuing a record deal. And someone turned me on to their hammer dulcimer and said, basically, you know, feel free to play it. Well, I was mystified. I didn't play any melodic instruments, and it didn't make any sense to me. I was very intimidated. And then she basically showed me some parameters of how it's laid out. And because I was a drummer and it's percussive, by the third time I played it, this one stormy night, literally, I just had this outrageous music roaring out of me. And it was the first time I really experienced being played by music itself. And it was like, oh, okay, I understand. I'm supposed to have one of these. And so I ended up opening the door to my spiritual path at the same time, researching my ancestral heritage, left the rock and roll business, and moved to Mount Shasta, California, and started playing hammer dulcimer. And that was back in, 1994, and recorded my first cassette that year, Living the Magic, and my first CD in 1998, Awakening Remembrance. And, it's gone on to be this really beautiful expression, and I combine it often with playing the various Native American flutes that I play, and it's a beautiful circle. So Summer Solstice, the piece that you're going to play for this wonderful gathering of souls who've been drawn to listen to your show, A Shamanic Life, is the piece that I traditionally close any event with. It would definitely be the one I'd want us to play on when we're on our way out. And
okay,
I think
great.
That's probably pretty close to where we're at in our time.
But so before we go, if folks want to get in touch with you, get to know your work better, we want to direct.
Great. Yes. My website is gentlethunder.com. And yes, that really is my name. It's on my driver's license. And you can reach me at gt@gentlethunder.com. It's a fun website that has mostly what I have been doing. It doesn't have, I'm building a new site with Robin, RobinAlexis and GentleThunder.com. if you want to type that in, you'll get a link to our contact page. And there's a wonderful article that was written about a session someone had. Jennifer Matthews wrote a beautiful article, and there's a link to that as well. And it give you a deeper sense of what I'm doing these days, as well as some photos and sound samples, links to all my albums and all that good stuff.
Excellent.
Is on gentlethunder.com. I love to hear from people. I love to make relationship, you know, so let's connect and to be the ceremony, to be the connection, and to be the oneness together.
All right. Thank you, Gentle. Thank you so much for sharing time with us and your this is summer solstice.
Thanks for having me here tonight, John, and for all
Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows, LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows, LIVE for Evolve with Robin White Turtle Lisney, Thursday afternoon at 2 p.m.